rejection has something of value. So if it is around selling a product, it's maybe learning what doesn't work or what's not a good strategy for selling.
Plug into the minds of the world's cutting-edge innovators, visionaries, and thought leaders who are rewriting the rules of sales and success. It's your time to make an impact. I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Selling with Love podcast. I'm very excited to have a conversation here about a topic that needs to be addressed today more than any other time, which is all about conflict resolution. It's about negotiation, and whether it's professionally used in the field of sales or in your everyday interaction, it feels like today we are more divided than ever. We are intolerable when it comes to anybody who disagrees with us, and we're trying to find a way that we can actually reestablish communication, realize that conflict isn't mean the end of the conversation, but maybe the beginning of something amazing. And I'm so excited to have two authors, former teachers of Harvard. I have Robert Bardone joining me. He's the co-author of Designing Systems and Processes for Managing Dispute and co-editor of the Handbook for Dispute Resolution. I also have Joel Salinas, who's an MD, behavioral neurologist, clinical scientist at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, co-founder and chief medical officer at Isaac Health, former Harvard Medical School faculty as well. And they come together as co-authors of the book Conflict Resilience, Negotiating Disagreement Without Giving Up or Giving In. And as I've mentioned, it's time to have a conversation of what does conflict mean? How do we actually see it as maybe the seeds of growing something better? And in today's times where it seems like everybody's very much in a disagreement, how do we start building bridges instead of burning them down? Gentlemen, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have both of you here.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Happy to be here.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So, this book is coming out very soon, but I know it's something that you've both been working on for quite a few years. You both have written multiple books in the past, so I'm wondering what got you inspired about going in this direction of putting a book on conflict together, especially in today's time?
Yeah, well, thanks for having us. And this is kind of a fun story because it's a story of really kind of friendship conversation turning into a book idea. So my whole professional life has been on negotiation and conflict resolution, as you said, Jason. I would say that beginning around 2015, 2016, I started to notice something really changed and different in my students at Harvard Law School. And I think it's something that probably many people started to observe, which was just this real unwillingness and resistance, really, to engage directly around difference and conflict. And I saw that coming up, you know, in all sorts of things like a trigger warning, which would say, like, this is uncomfortable. I don't want to be in this classroom. Or just the knowledge. I had served on the admissions committee at Harvard Law School, and I know that we work really hard to bring diverse student body together. And yet you wouldn't see that reflected so much in the student body. In the class, you would see boring, anodyne conversation, even though we knew that people had really strongly and different divergent views. And so this kind of reluctance struck me not simply as a deficit of skills, but a deficit of mindset. And that's where this idea of conflict resilience came up. Enter my friendship with Joelle, and just, you know, as you could see, I already have this tendency to kind of talk on and on about things that I'm passionate about. And Joel and I would talk about this, and we actually found that there was actually a shared passion coming from a slightly different orientation and experience. And then it was really Joel who said, maybe there's a book here. So Joel, why don't I let you pick it up from there?
Yeah. You know, as we were talking about our own interests, you know, I was really focused on kind of understanding like the mechanisms of empathy in the brain, but also a lot of the research that I do is around social relationships and how it influences our brain health. And as Bob would share his perspectives with me about kind of the challenges that people are having, I did kind of notice that there's been kind of a big trend around people becoming more lonely. That's a big problem. There's also a lot more social isolation. And I think those two ideas start to kind of click that there may be a relationship there. And that's where Bob really told me about kind of these experiences that he was having. And I was also seeing them within kind of the medical school, within the hospital, and all sorts of patient interactions, that there really is this kind of almost like allergy to conflict that people will avoid even like the hint of conflict at any cost whatsoever. And that's a real big problem, partly because at the core of what helps to build connection is conflict. You know, I think part of the hypothesis here that Bob and I have is, you know, without conflict, there is no connection. And so what we really want to do is really kind of change the way that we all think about conflict as a whole, as well as to help to provide the kind of tools and the skills to help people be better equipped to be able to kind of really sit with and be with that discomfort.
That's very interesting. I was going to say, Bob, you mentioned you've noticed maybe some of this amplifying around maybe the 2015s onward. And I'm just wondering, is this something that's a cyclical thing we go through as humans? Or is it something that emerged and is technology to blame? Like, is that where we're pointing the finger?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I think there's a lot of contributing factors. Technology is definitely one of them. It's much easier now to escape the discomfort, right? We can create these kind of culture cocoons of common thinking. The algorithm is set up for that. If you think about, you know, just a few decades ago when I was a kid, right, things more geographically bound, you had to figure out how to make it work. Now we have these highly curated communities we can create. So I think that's one factor. You know, part of when I was first thinking about this idea of conflict resilience, this may or may not surprise like your listeners, I was actually listening to a talk about the opioid epidemic. And this talk was kind of saying like, yes, obviously big pharma had a lot to do with it and doctors had a lot to do with it. But that was driven by a market, and particularly a market of people who said, I don't want to feel an ounce of pain. Give me something. And I actually think there's a real analogy there around conflict. Like sitting in the discomfort of the disagreement isn't easy. It does take a certain kind of resilience. And it has become easier to escape that discomfort, even though what Joelle and I would say is at very great cost, both to relationships and organizations, and then more broadly at a societal level. But it's easy to escape. And we don't want to kind of feel that discomfort. And so I would just say that in addition to technology, I think that there is a broader cultural shift that if it causes you pain or discomfort, may go away and may go away in the easiest possible way. I think part of our invitation and really strong belief here is that the opportunity for, as Joelle said, connection, and also the opportunity for actual problem solving and results actually is not around the conflict, it's through the conflict. And if we don't develop that resilient capability, we can never get to problem solving. And then we're left with a bunch of conflict handling methods that don't ultimately serve us. They serve us in a moment, but they don't serve us and our interests in the long term.
Joel, I was going to throw it at you since you've probably done a lot of studies around like, how do we naturally grow and face conflicts maybe as growing up? And I'm wondering if there's been changes in the way that we grow up. The first thing that comes to mind is like helicopter parent culture.
You know, that's so funny. That was literally where my mind was going. Yeah. So, you know, we don't really have like classes in kind of conflict skills or conflict management. There's been a lot of work in socio-emotional learning done in childhood. There's been a lot of emphasis put on that, but it doesn't always have really good kind of curricula and like how do you manage really difficult situations. So a lot of the times where we learn kind of how to handle conflict is from our parents first, right? It's from our parents first and the people around us and our experiences. And so our brain, as we are kind of seeing these things, as we are kind of reacting to the world around us, is starting to create kind of loops or systems. It's basically telling us kind of, this was the outcome, do this again. So this kind of reward and reinforcement loop. So For example, if somebody told you, no, you can't have one more candy bar, and you reacted by yelling and screaming and knocking things over, and then you got the candy bar, your brain at that point is telling you, okay, to get what I want, I need to fight this. I need to just yell, scream, I need to plow through the other person, and then I'll get what I want. And that can eventually kind of, over time, become this very well-worn behavioral loop where whenever you have potential conflict coming up, your first reaction is to go into kind of crisis mode and attack mode and just like yell over the other person, or it's like my way or the highway, which certainly doesn't serve an organization well, doesn't kind of serve kind of the team well. And, you know, these kind of default reactions to conflict, we call them a set that we think are very, very common. We call the five Fs. That's like fight, flight, freeze, fawn, and fester. So they're very common reactions that we can have to conflict, or even just the perception of conflict. And you may, if you think back to your experiences, you may use one more than the other. There may be certain situations where you'd be more prone to kind of freezing, and in other situations, maybe you'd be more prone to kind of fawning. But either way, you know, these kind of default reactions may not really serve us in the long term. They may give us an immediate kind of decrease in the discomfort, but this kind of way of avoiding the discomfort of conflict, all it does is increase our sensitization to that kind of threat response to conflict, which then makes us want to use those default reactions more and more and more. And so we're kind of stuck in a place where we have to really fight against our brain, which is really there to protect us, but may not necessarily have the wherewithal of kind of what is in our best interest.
It's very interesting that you use that handy analogy from childhood, because I often share an example in my talks where is that the result of you being a kid that's just like, can I hit that candy? Please, please, please. And like, you're kind of shameless as a kid because you just keep asking it to keep asking. And how I interpret that exercise, or I share it, is actually in the concept that, and it's reflected from my childhood, is at some point a parent will say, no means no, stop asking. And when that happens, then it makes you go into more of a freeze or some sort of like flight reaction. And I speak about it when it comes to sales, like someone says, no, I don't want your product or service. People are so afraid of following up because I don't want to annoy that other person. And now you're, again, avoiding this conflict, which maybe is just a question of handling objections at this point. And so right now, it sounds like we have a lot of coping mechanisms anytime we come to a conflict, an objection, something that's not fully going our way. What's been the reaction to that? Like, I'm seeing symptoms of this is like you have cancel kind of culture is one of them. People isolating, you've mentioned the loneliness. Are there other consequences that we're seeing in the way that the world is today based on this skill not being trained?
I mean, I think there are many, right? I mean, one is, I mean, the kind of way in which, I mean, I'm seeing this playing out in a U.S. context. Literally today, three different people wrote to me and said, I'm no longer on X, I'm on Blue Sky. So these are these, right, different, you know, social media places. And I get it. I mean, I get that people have objections to whatever Elon Musk, but what that intentional separation is doing is actually making things worse. So it is an act of removal, right, which is different from canceling somebody, right? Which is different from, I would say, like within universities, right? We see these ideas of trigger warnings. And in our book, like we make a very big distinction between subjecting yourself to ongoing trauma or abuse, which we do not call for, versus actually putting yourself into situations of discomfort because we need to develop that as a leadership skill, as a business skill. So I think there's a bunch of these dynamics going on all at the same time. And I think that they compound and they escalate. And I would say one of the challenging aspects, I think, of what our book offers or tries to offer is I think that there is a sense that engagement with others who are opposed to us is a waste of time. There's so little we agree on anyway. You're mostly in opposition to me. It's better for me to spend my time with my people than trying to find some ounce of common ground with you. And I think what we really try to make the case of is that that is a mistake at a bunch of different levels. First of all, often there actually is common ground if you could cultivate that curiosity. So just to use your example, Jason, which I love, right? When the customer or potential customer says, no, I don't want that. Like, what does cultivating curiosity in that moment, genuine curiosity, mean and look like? If it's just a performative, curious question, it will look performative and look trained. If you respond by saying, oh, well, you definitely want this, let me tell you more about it, that's kind of annoying, frankly. It's like, don't tell me what I want, you know? Or if you just walk away, you might have lost an opportunity, right? So in that moment, how do you cultivate the curiosity and then somehow be able to demonstrate? And this is, I think, the work of the book. We talk about this thing called the BBO, the bigger, better offer, right? Someone has to see that there's a bigger, better offer at the end of that work. And I think right now people are not having these kinds of engagements because they don't see that. They only see the work. They don't see the possible gain. So part of this is, I think, a combination for us of both telling some real stories of that, both from both of our professional lives and personal lives, and also just from actual like higher profile stories, also giving some tactics, and then also really talking about, you know, what is going on in our brain in these moments and what are some moves that we can make to retrain the brain to see that BBO or that bigger, better offer.
No, I think one thing that could be really relevant to your audience, let's say you're an entrepreneur and you're looking to pitch to a VC, for example, right? Or you're doing some business development and you're looking to pitch to kind of a potential really big partner. If you don't have this conflict resilience muscle really trained and conditioned, it's definitely going to affect your performance when you're doing that pitch. Because if you're coming into that pitch already worried about kind of the objections that are going to come up or how they're going to look at you or kind of them disagreeing kind of with fact ABC in your deck, you're going to be flustered. Your mind is going to be elsewhere. And that's going to really hurt your confidence. And that really will really translate when you're doing that pitch. And then in the middle of that pitch, when questions do come up and you get a big objection, because you're always going to get a big objection, right? Because part of the job of, you know, the other side of the pitch is to poke holes. If you don't feel comfortable when that happens, it's going to derail you, get really distracted. And part of that is your own physiology, right? It's this kind of mechanism that we have in our body to protect ourselves from threats, which is kind of your heart rate increases, blood pressure goes up, your muscles contract. And then all of the kind of activity and kind of blood flow to the parts of your brain that are much more deliberative, that are really there for good judgment, planning, or organization, that starts to go offline. And all that attention then goes to your limbic system, these kind of parts of your brain that are really focused on kind of the fight flight, kind of how to protect yourself from that saber-toothed tiger. And so your responses are likely to sound very canned, or you're just going to come across like you're not really confident in what you're trying to pitch. So I think conflict resilience, no matter what you do, is this kind of really, really fundamental kind of like muscle that we should all be conditioning. And there's a really strong part of our own kind of brain wiring that we have to kind of like really program and really strengthen.
I like the fact that paying attention to this, especially on a business context, you've already mentioned you're probably losing out deals because you're not even seeing that there's a bigger opportunity beyond that conflict. You're just giving up, basically. And there's another one, which is if you're someone that's more reactionary. So imagine you're going to offer your product and service and people says like, oh, that sounds terrible. And you flip out on them being like, you don't understand. You're so stupid. You don't like, now your brand is being affected. So not having trained this muscle becomes a liability for your business and becomes a really wasteful way of dealing with leads that might've came your way that you actually haven't extracted and demonstrated value to. And so it sounds like this training of the muscle to deal with conflict is a very important part of that. Is it possible to train it even though you're maybe listening to this being like, oh, I'm such a volatile person, or oh, I can't even fathom being in a conflict. This seems impossible to me.
It's definitely something that can be trained. And I think one of the things that we try to kind of emphasize in the book is if you were learning to kind of play tennis, you're not going to come out the gate playing like Venus or Serena Williams. You're going to have to kind of figure out kind of where you're at, kind of do your own kind of self-assessment, and then take these skills and at a minimum, become more aware of kind of how you kind of exist within conflict. you know, that awareness of your perception of kind of what is conflict, your ability to kind of hold that conflict, these types of things, you know, awareness is way more than half the battle in that process of training that muscle.
What I would say there, right, is, you know, just to take your examples, right, the person who tends to kind of react in an aggressive way, part of the work they have to do, and really the first third of our book is all about, I think, becoming more aware of yourself. Okay, so there's a side of them that maybe feels offended, that feels like they're right, that feels like they need to sell this idea. That shouldn't be quieted, evaluated, silenced. But there's probably also a side of them, if we really ask them to dig deep, that is a little bit of curious about where the objection is coming from. And so the work there is, how do I give voice to both of those sides in myself without getting all judgmental about them? And then how do I effectively voice both of those sides in the conversation? And that's where that's neither avoidant nor aggressive. And it's both and. For the person who maybe is more likely to shut down or feel bad or apologize, the work is, how do you find that side of yourself that 5 minutes ago kind of knew you had something to offer? And where did that go? And why doesn't that get a bit more voice? And so, you know, in our book, we kind of literally talk about setting up multiple chairs to give voice to all of these sides. And I think what can happen, and this goes back to some of our earlier conversation that we had here around family of origin or upbringing, is that we often have gotten messages depending on our family, and not even the family, the role we played in our family, maybe birth order or something, right? That this side is selfish, or this side is no good, or this side doesn't need to be fed, you have to take care of them, whatever it might be. And so how do we kind of create, you know, what we call like a judgment lockbox? Take that judgment aside, like listen and play out these different voices, and then find a way to bring them into the room, right? So we call this mirror work, chair work, and table work, right? The mirror work is looking objectively at ourselves, as objectively as we can, but meaning not to allow these what we call circus mirror distortions that are filled with kind of evaluation get in the way of just assessing, is there anything legitimate or illegitimate about this side or this side or this side? The chair work, right, is what does it look like to just give an actual audible voice to each of those sides? And then the table work is, okay, now what does it look like in the actual conversation and doing the actual conversation? And so much of the work, as you know, Joelle says, is, I think, this self-awareness piece. And one of the things that we would say, just to kind of carry that tennis analogy, which I think is could be tennis or playing piano or whatever, right, is each of us may have a natural overall skill set, but wherever that skill set is, it's movable. Really, none of you would ever want to play tennis with me. But like the more I know about tennis, the more aware I am, the more self-reflective I am, the more open I am to coaching, I'm going to get better. I'll still stink. And Serena Williams, like up until her last day as a professional tennis player, and maybe still now, I don't know, but she had a coach. It's kind of interesting, right? And she was reflective about her practice. She didn't just say, like, I'm naturally great, I'm done. And so I think that's also the invitation for, hopefully, for your listeners, wherever they're falling on a spectrum as they listen to this, ranging from, you know, I'm the international mediator, best negotiator, won the prize, to, you know, I couldn't negotiate myself out of a paper bag, right? Anywhere in that continuum, there's opportunity for growth. The more you know about the topic, the more self-reflective you are, and the more open you are to coaching and feedback.
As a business owner, entrepreneur, someone running an agency, having the top-tier website is very important, and you're more than likely running your business on WordPress. but are you hosting on the best platform possible? That's why I'm excited to bring Kinsta as our sponsor for today's podcast, which allows you for faster load time, top-tier security, and human-only best-in-class customer support. So if you're looking to have your website hosted on WordPress on the best platform, Kinsta really goes above and beyond to make sure your websites load fast, your SEO is working well, you get the support you need, and you get to keep focused on your business. Are you ready to experience Kinsta's hosting for yourself? Get the free month when you sign up at kinsta.com today. It's the perfect opportunity to see why Kinsta is trusted by thousands of businesses worldwide to power their website. Visit kinsta.com and get this limited time offer for new customers on select plans. Don't miss out. Get started for free today. I think that openness to coaching and feedback is probably something I want to encourage in myself and anybody else listening, because I find it very easy to think, no, I'm way more workable than everyone else out there. And this all sounds great, but no one else out there is going to be caring or considerate or is going to want to even, like, I'm going to show up to the tennis court, I won't be that good. And the person on the other side, they're just going to be sitting on the floor looking away. And like, I want to go back to the fact that you mentioned your friends. They said, I'm leaving this place to go to another social media platform because I don't want to interact. They've completely cut off the conversation, right? So what happens when we take that initiative to be better at conflict resolution, but you're still looking out there and it seems like no one is even wanting to lift a finger?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's really counterintuitive about kind of conflict resilience is, you know, a lot of the kind of the yeah buts that we have about it will often be kind of looking at the other side of the table, the people that they're the problem. And I think to Bob's point, you know, we actually would say that you really need to start internal first. And that's actually one of the hardest things, is that you do have to do some of your own internal work, whether it's around identity or it's around kind of your history with conflict or managing like mental health, right? There are some people who have some mental health issues that relate to kind of feelings of threat or kind of real fear just interacting with other people. And so that work, that internal work, is just so important before you can really become much more skillful at managing the interaction across the table, because we would argue that conflict resilience is applicable regardless of, you know, the level of skill of the person across the table.
One of the things I would also say, because I think this question, and it's something I've heard a lot, right, is the, well, I don't have a partner on the other side. Right. And there's something about it that is very easy to explain away the problem or externalize a problem. It's also the case, though, I think, that there are ways around that. You know, we kind of discuss this a little bit in our book. We actually have an example in there about there are two siblings and they are fighting over a political issue. And one,
like, that never happens.
Like, that never happens. Right. Yeah. You know, the way it's set up kind of is one does a very early exit all the time, making the other think, like, what's wrong with you? Like, you either A, realize you're defeated, so that's why you leave, or you're no fun, or you don't like me, or you're just a person of bad faith, right? But conversation to get things on track sometimes is, and this may sound very meta, but just in the kind of coaching work that I've done can be really powerful, is, can we have a conversation about what makes the conversation hard? Which is, right, very meta, right? But like, I've observed, you know, a resistance. I've observed this, and framing it from that perspective of, I've observed and here's the behavior and what's your reaction to that? Now, you still may get the same avoidance, right? I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to talk about that. I think more often than not, you don't get that. You might not get the most skillful and amazing answer. You might even get something like, this is weird. But this is weird is still an invitation to engagement. And if part of your complaint is they're not engaging, that is engagement. And that's a first step, right? And sometimes it could be the negotiation first is, what are the ground rules and expectations about how do we talk about this? Not just agree to disagree. Agree to disagree to me is a shut. Let's agree to disagree.
I hate that statement. Agree to disagree is such a cop out.
It's such a cop-out. And maybe because, you know, one of my personal evolutions, I mean, I think many people who do conflict resolution work, this is like a dangerous thing to say, but there's not probably that many conflict resolution people listening to this, right? Like what draws them to it is their own like inability to handle it. I mean, I would put myself in that category. And also being somebody who is pretty avoidant. And I think the more work I've done in this, and certainly I think this book, I mean, to poor Joelle's detriment, I've been like an invitation. Sometimes I feel like I'm a conflict creator. I mean, that's not fair. But even as a mediator, right, I have found that if people are saying, oh, no, we're on the same page and you're listening and you thought like this person said A and this person said, you know, A minus, and they're saying they agree, but I know they don't agree. The most convenient thing to do would be like, fabulous, I'm glad we're done with that issue. But that is a mistake, right? And so often what I'll say is, you know, I know you guys say your agreement, but frankly, I'm hearing something different here. And so sometimes I find myself in the role of bringing up the conflict more. And I think that's a personal shift that I've had, both from the study of this, the practice of this, and the teaching of this over, you know, a long time.
And to be clear, bringing up the conflict is a good thing. Like you want to bring up the conflict because that's going to lead to kind of better creativity, people being more authentic to each other. It's going to lead to better kind of productivity. It's going to lead to better cohesion together. Because if you just say, you know, agree to disagree and then kind of move on, knowing that you don't really actually agree, it's going to come back. It's going to come back and bite you in the end.
And it's almost always the case that the kind of anxiety or fear about engaging the conflict is worse than actually engaging it. And so once we start to realize that, I mean, this is another, you know, I don't know why I'm calling it an insight, but it's a personal insight just from a long, you know, many years of coaching people and having people then come back and say, yeah, that was like, it didn't go as I thought, but here's the one thing for sure. It was not nearly as bad as like all of the disasters I had planned in my mind. And then getting them to encode that so that this next time the story for themselves is it's better to engage this now authentically. And as Joelle said, even when at the end of the day, we've had a really hard conversation in strong disagreement on A, B, C, D, and E, there's a connection there. I would say, you know, maybe hearkening back to your maybe first question, Jason, about just like, how do we come to some of this? Like for me, you know, I gave you half the story, which was what I was observing at Harvard Law School. The other half of the story is work that I was doing with an organization and continue to do with an organization called Seeds of Peace, which does work in a number of conflict zones, but primarily and historically between Israeli and Palestinian young leaders. And, you know, traveling every year for many years to East Jerusalem and working with these people. And I have to say, like, at the end of their work together, they don't have much agreement on the issues. But you know what has utterly transformed? The way they tell the story about the other, their experience of the other, their ability to cooperate in a whole bunch of other domains. And boy, the gains to conflict resilience there, if more people had that, are pretty darn high. And so to see that in a context like that, and then to see that capacity actually declining in an American context, you know, at an elite law school, gosh, that troubled me, right? And then to see the way, you know, we see more and more polarization, both in the United States, but, you know, across the world, and saying like, we have some work to do here, people, you know?
Oh, and I couldn't help but think of my own situations where as a leader, I've plowed through and I've seen people just verbally agree to something being like, great, let's stop this comment. Like me wanting to avoid going into the weeds in the sake of moving forward on the progress. And I definitely am not feeling like I'm above it all. I definitely have a lot of work to do in this space. I'm definitely on the avoidance side as well. And what I have witnessed when you take the time of every conflict that I've had is on the other side, we've always been able to leave with more clarity, more momentum in the direction we need to go. And I think that invitation to pause and lean in whenever there is that an intuitive hit almost that there's maybe not as much cohesion between the team as you think, and poking at it as not to create conflict, but poking at the underlying conflict, which is kept unconscious. Whether you avoid it or address it, the conflict is there and it will burn.
And I was just going to say, you know, to be clear, you know, around kind of what conflict resilience is not, you know, it's not about barreling into the conflict even when it doesn't make sense to do it, right? Like if you're in a big meeting and then somebody makes a comment that is really incendiary, you know, that's not the time to bring it up, right? But you do want to bring it up at some point, right? The other thing that conflict resilience is not is kind of about tolerating abuse or like legitimate threats to your like well-being. We were very clear. We have a whole section about it in the book around kind of finding ways to better understand what is it that a situation is actually not one worth kind of engaging in at the time because it's really not safe. What we really want to focus on with conflict resilience is those situations where there's something to potentially be gained, where it's more about kind of disagreements across lines of difference or conflicts around things where you have somebody on the other side of the table that's acting in good faith.
One of the things around, I think timing is so important here. And there's like different ways of thinking about timing, right? There's the Joel example that he gave, right, around a holiday dinner table is just probably not a good time. There's also like, what is the timing for yourself? So again, just speaking autobiographically about today, I mean, I had a friend text me today who, you know, knows that this book is launching and we're recording this in the first week of the Trump presidency. And the person's like, do you really think you could do this stuff right now? And I thought like, sounds like you're struggling to do it right now. And that's actually okay. Part of what we talk about and discuss is how do you understand like your own emotions, which doesn't mean actually that you do the conversation when you don't have emotions. But there are times when there is kind of a, like the phrase we use in the book that Joel came up with, limbic irritability. As a lay non-neurologist, I just love that word. I go around saying it. People think like, wow, Bob like knows something. Like it's just not a good time, right? It's just like, so you have to know for yourself. You also have to like know for the other person. Or set of people. I mean, I have, you know, again, this kind of comes from my own coaching practice. You coach someone, they have to have a conversation with their boss or the CEO or whatever, or you know, whatever. Let's just use that example. And, you know, they're stressed about it. You've practiced it. And then they come back to you next week and they're like, I did it. It was a disaster. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, tell me about it. Like, well, I was worried about it all week and I was hand-wringing. And just on Friday morning, I said, like, I am not letting this day end before having it. And, you know, at like 3 in the afternoon, you know, as the boss is walking in the hall, they like, you know, pigeonhole them. And it's like, well, I mean, even if you were skillful, right? Like, I know you feel like you're checking it off of your to-do list, but it wasn't like set up right for them. And so there's a lot of setup work around timing and place. For all of our, like I would say, our strong thrust of this book, which is entering the fray with authenticity, with non-avoidance, is the thing to do, right? We also want to say, how do we do the at the right time, set it with the right setup, maximizing the chances it can land, and not land because we avoided the heart of the issue.
It sounds to me like one of the core things when you're leaning into conflict, you've built that resilience, is this intention going into it. And I'm wondering if there's a set of like guidelines, maybe a gut check questions that you can have when you know you need to address a conflict situation, that you can ask yourself, check in with yourself, that it's like, okay, I'm going at this maybe with the right, you know, foundation, as opposed to, like you said, the person was trying to check a box for a coach that they had by the end of the week. Probably not the right intention, because you're not even talking about the conflict at hand. What would be that kind of guidebook we could have, or those items we could check off?
Yeah. I mean, I think the first piece that I would say, and you know, Joel kind of check me and add on this, right? But am I in a place where there is something I'm genuinely could be curious about? That's really important. And that could take a lot of time, energy, and effort, particularly if we're really darn certain. If there's nothing you can be curious about, then I don't know what your task is. But honestly, it's actually hard to be persuasive without having some curiosity. I mean, I think secondly, like, what does a good outcome look like, right? So we talk about, and this is where I would say we probably are drawing on just some of the mutual gains or interest-based tradition of negotiation that's been out there for some time. And, you know, so not like, what is my position? Like, I want $50,000, but underlying that, right? Like, what are my kind of long and short-term hopes, concerns, goals, and interests, both substantively, also with respect to the relationship, emotionally? Like, so asking those kinds of questions. But then also, I think, asking the similar kinds of questions for the other person, right? And what would a good outcome for them be look like? And when I say good outcome, I could mean that from a negotiation perspective or just a good outcome from the conversation. So I think that there's some real prep work there. Joelle, why don't I turn it over to you? I think you could probably also offer some things that are a little more brainy.
We had talked a little bit about this bigger, better offer. And really, there's a part of the brain called the orbitofrontal cortex, which is really kind of your memory for how big of a reward you're likely to get from whatever behavior that you do. One of the things you're trying to reprogram is kind of recalibrating what the potential reward is from an interaction that you have. There was some really great work looking at, you know, can we train kind of compassion in people? Using kind of a very specific kind of compassion training, having them kind of go through this training in like 5 minutes, kind of every day for a couple of weeks. And what was seen kind of on kind of brain scans was that the parts of the brain that related to kind of social cognition became a lot more kind of connected with the dopamine kind of reward and reinforcement pathways of the brain. The idea being here that if you are able to really kind of hone in on the positive benefit to you by engaging in that difficult conflict, by kind of becoming curious about the position of the person and kind of really focusing on what is that thing that will benefit you, you're much more likely to do that. Your whole kind of physiology is going to lean in with you, but it takes that bit of kind of awareness of kind of reminding yourself, you know, this is the purpose, this is why this is helpful for me.
There was one thing I wanted to ask, which is more related towards a very common aspect of sales that might tie into lacking conflict resilience, which is fear of rejection. And I was curious to know, what have you noticed around, you know, particular people who are fearing rejection, are struggling to initiate conversations with strangers, which is very important in business, very important as you're selling in business, and how that ties to your inability to address conflict. Does that fall into the same kind of spectrum? And is there some stuff we can learn about that?
I think these things are related in some way. You know, whether kind of that fear of rejection comes with some rumination, like thinking about it over and over again, that can kind of cause a lot of distress. Or there's like catastrophizing, you know, like really only imagining the worst thing. These are these kind of like cognitive distortions that we can have. And kind of that fear of the possible negative outcomes, the potential threat, that is part of the things that can make engaging in conflict so challenging, is you're having to fight against kind of these networks that are there to protect you, like I said, but they're putting you in this fight or flight mode almost unnecessarily, or at times where you really don't need it. And so there's a lot that can be learned from kind of the world of exposure therapy, where people have kind of very specific phobias, but essentially there's something there about kind of managing the doubts that you have about the outcome of engaging, because there's a lot of like, what if that comes up? Like, what if they reject me? What if they say no? What if this means that I'm weak? What if they will get upset at me for challenging and I lose my job? But one of the ways that you can kind of recalibrate that, aside from, you know, taking like a long deep breath, right, and kind of like pausing, but bringing in some phrases for yourself that can help to kind of take your mind away from doing what you typically would do, which is some kind of like a response to that situation, which is one of those default reactions, right? Like avoiding it, fighting, whatever. And you can tell yourself something like, you know, we don't know what'll happen. There's no way of knowing what's going to come from that interaction. We don't have the information. to know what's going to happen. And just being able to kind of repeat these kinds of little mantras for yourself until you actually really believe them can really help to kind of break you out of kind of that cycle of wanting to react with what you typically react, which might be kind of that avoidance out of a fear of rejection or a fear of kind of, you know, some big catastrophic thing happening.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say around this, right, is the side of you that fears rejection, just to kind of use some of the language of our book, is actually one of the sides. So just be like, there's a side of me that I may get rejected, but then also being able to name to yourself, and there's a side of me that might be persuasive. And then to say, what is the consequence of being rejected? So, and I think this is where the self-awareness work comes in, because someone who has that very high fear may have had some really bad experience of getting rejected, right? And so there's something protective going on that's making that voice much louder than the voice of you have something of value to say or something of value to sell or something about, you know, value to offer. And so the work there is not to say the fear of rejection voice is terrible, false, a sign of your weakness. No, like it's there and it's there because you've learned something and it probably has some value. Let's evaluate it. And also there's the other side. And okay, like I'll take my chances, right? And part of what we would say is that the other side of that, even if it's rejection, has something of value. So if it is around selling a product, it's maybe learning what doesn't work or what's not a good strategy for selling. If it's rejection of a relationship, like I don't want to be friends with you anymore, you know, I don't want to date you anymore. Well, you know what? It's kind of good that you actually had that conversation now and not in year 22 of your relationship. Or the only way you got to year 22 was the whole side of you that wanted to put forward this set of ideas was silenced because you were afraid that if they actually found out, they'd kick you to the corner. That can't possibly be a good outcome.
Right.
Gentlemen, there's a lot that we've covered today, and I'm going to give my little recap on that. But I do have to ask one question to both of you, which is a question I ask all my guests, which is, you are on the Selling with Love podcast. So starting with you, Joel, what does selling with love mean to you?
Oh, I would say that is the intention around trying to bring some value to the other person. So if you're doing something with love, you're doing it to benefit them, to bring something positive, and there's that relational piece. And I mean, I could go into like the neurocircuitry around kind of like love that relates to like trust and affection and affiliation. But really, I see it as like, it's less about trying to get something and more about trying to help support the other person.
And Bob, if I ask you the same question, what does selling with love mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has a very, that won't surprise you, very negotiation aspect to it at least two levels, right? One is somehow the notion that the best way to sell is by just understanding who they are, right? Like their heart, their perspective, their story, and framing in that way. The other thing is that I actually love the title of the podcast because it feels like it's really framed to a really broad audience. So I feel like you did that naming it. And that seems like a negotiation move, right? Because it piques your curiosity of, wait a minute, is this about sales? Is this about relationship? Is this about building love? And so it draws a lot of people in. And so I love that aspect to it, which makes me want to ask you, but maybe you have to do this all the time. You can't do it. What does it mean to you?
Well, the official definition in the book, Selling with Love, is selling is an energy exchange between conscious beings. And when you know what you offer is so much more than what you ask in return, then love's the emotion that balances the equation. And so that's my mathematical answer. So we had the neurology, the negotiation, and then I have the mathematics. But gentlemen, honestly, this has been a fantastic conversation. A couple things that I love to highlight. for myself and even for everybody listening here is the first thing I realize is, okay, conflict, it is a muscle we need to train. I think that in today's generation, we've been most weaker. Maybe it's in the more recent methods of parenting that made it so that we don't approach conflict. I mean, there's no curriculum around it. You guys have shared how this is kind of something that evolved over time. Technology, yeah, it's easy to point the finger, but played a role, but nonetheless, this is where we are now. So yes, there's things that we're going to need to learn to be better at conflict. There's a lot of consequences. We're seeing the divide. We're seeing correlation around, you know, epidemic of loneliness. You guys have spoke about this opioid epidemic. It's like everyone's just trying to, you know, numb themselves, be in comfort, find themselves in cultural bubbles. You see the divide around political spectrum or any other spectrum where you just want to be around people that agree with you so you can avoid conflict at every cost. But there's is a cost. It's a massive cost. And I love that you talk about the bigger, better offer is on the other side of every conflict. And I think just like switching that concept, as you suggested, which is, wow, behind every conflict is an opportunity for a better offer that's even bigger than what I imagine, at least sparks what seems to be the key ingredient in all of this is keeping curiosity front of mind. And to me, this is so well nurtured value to keep in mind in every sales interaction, because as you show curiosity in the other person, and if you're in the business of solving problems, which is how I frame sales, you're going to face conflict. And if you have that energy of curiosity, then you might get to that bigger, better offer, which maybe, hey, maybe they said no to your $100 offer, but maybe there's a $1,000 offer behind the door because now you're asking questions that are about being curious. You're leaning into it. And quite frankly, there's also this huge epidemic of loss of trust because nobody's really wanting to lean in with saying what they truly think. And I think when you lean into conflict and you start having these open conversations, I can think of every single time I've left a conversation that was of conflict, whether in my relationship, like romantic relationship, in the business world, on the other side, intimacy was formed. In the great way of seeing that I got closer to the other person, we found alignment and we built momentum. And so whether it's applying the concepts of your book in sales, leadership, and even in, you know, my personal life, I walk away from this just really realizing, yeah, conflict has always been an ally. Don't run away from it. See the ways that it's healthy to engage into it. And quite frankly, if a lot more people start having these kinds of conversation, not by blaming the other person, but starting with ourselves, hey, we start leveling it up for everyone else. And so I'm very excited for the book. Everyone, if you're paying attention, it's coming out soon by the time this episode is released. If you're listening to it past March 2025, then it's already out there. Pick it up on the various bookshelves. You can go to conflictresiliencebooks.com or just find it on Amazon. We'll put some links in the show notes. Make sure you can discover all the work from Joel and Bob as well. Gentlemen, it was an absolute pleasure having you on the show. And thank you for bringing the uncomfortable topic of conflict to the front, because I think getting more comfortable with that is going to be a benefit for humanity as a whole. I am your host, Jason Mark Campbell, and this is the Selling with Love podcast.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So, you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So, whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.